Next section, 1.5, paying attention to the elements. Furthermore, a monastic examines their own body, whatever its placement or posture, according to the elements. In this body, there is the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. It is as if a skilled butcher or a butcher's apprentice were to kill a cow and sit down at the crossroads with the meat cut into portions. In the same way, a monastic examines their own body, whatever its placement or posture, according to the elements. In this body, there is the earth element, water element, fire element, and air element. In this way, they meditate by observing an aspect of the body internally, externally, and so on. Okay, so here we have a very simple teaching on the elements, basically just lifting them and giving that somewhat striking simile. Obviously, it would have been quite a common sight to see that kind of thing at the crossroads or whatever, the marketplace. And then you see the animals cut up into bits. And these days, of course, we try to hide the fact that the meat that we buy in the supermarket or whatever is actually made up of cut-up animals. Usual kind of euphemistic names and wrap it up in plastic and all of these kinds of things. But actually, that's all it is animals that have been cut into bits. Except these days, it's animals that have been cut into bits and then stuff full of all kinds of chemicals to make them look bright and fresh and pink. So there's that as well. Anyway, so to look a bit deeper at what's going on with this thing on the element, actually in the suttas, the meditation on the elements is taught a lot of times. It's quite a significant meditation, and it's one of the meditations that's actually taught in the most detail. It's also one of the meditations that's discussed in the most detail in the Visuddhimagga. In fact, it might be, I'd have to check it, but I think it might be the longest and most detailed of all the meditations in the Visuddhimagga, which gives you an idea of how significant this practice is, certainly for the Buddhist tradition. These days, it doesn't tend to be taught explicitly so much. And I think it's only in the Pauk tradition, as far as I know, that they really kind of emphasize doing that meditation a lot. Other places they do it, but not with such emphasis or such detail. So clearly, in doing this teaching on the elements, the Buddha was drawing from an understanding of the physical world, which was prevalent at his time. Without going into too much detail into the background of this, you see a similar tendencies not only in India but also in Greece and in China as well, where you find the sort of attempts to sort of draw up a list of sort of fundamental elements of which the world is made up of. And in the different Greek philosophers, you find a number of different lists that are given of the elements. They're all kind of similar kinds of things, but they might vary a bit. And in China you find the list, what is it, the six elements or something? Chinese philosophy, anyone know? I think wood is one of them. They have like metal, fire, what is it? Sorry? Added to the other ones. Yeah, so the other stuff's wood and metal and so on. So you have different, slight variations, but a similar kind of thing. Now, the Buddhist list of elements, of all of them, is probably the most scientific, I mean, you'd have to say. I mean, it corresponds exactly with the what we learned in high school about what the different states of matter are, right? So the states of matter, solid, liquid, and gas, and they correspond exactly with the air element, water element, and air element. And the heat element, of course, is the element of transformation, okay? And again, that's exactly how it's depicted in the Buddhist tradition, so that heat is the element that's responsible for change, for aging, and so on. And of course, in the physical understanding of the elements, it's heat which moves, changes an element from solid to liquid, from liquid to gas, and back again. Yeah? So the Buddhist understanding of the elements, in fact, is very scientific. In many places, you find added to these list of four elements also the space element. And in some traditions, especially the Sarvastivadin tradition, the space element, like the Sarvastivadin tradition is where most of the early suttas that are found in Chinese and Sanskrit and also Tibetan are from that kind of group of schools. And in those texts, you usually find five elements instead of four, and the fifth element being the element of space. Sometimes also the element of consciousness is added to that as well. So space, of course, being an interesting element and being discussed in a lot of detail in Buddhist philosophy about whether space actually exists or not. Okay? I mean, one aspect of Buddhist philosophy is whether anything exists, okay? So if you get past whether anything exists and whether the four elements exist, even if you admit that there are things that really exist, then you're still left over the question, what about space? Does that kind of exist or does not exist? And different schools argue for different interpretations of that. One of the reasons why it's a significant problem is because there are very similes used that compare Nibbana with space. Okay, and so it influences or affects the question of how we conceive Nibbana. So there's one sort of tendency in the Buddhist tradition to regard space as what they call a Swabhava Dhamma, is something which has its own inherent essence, something that really exists. Whereas, in fact, in the suttas, there's a number of passages that seem to make it clear that how the Buddha was thinking about space was not something which exists in itself, but something which arises because of the relationship between the other elements. Okay? So space is not something that inherently exists, but space is basically the gap between other elements. And that's pretty much also how space is conceived in modern physics as well. And so if you look in physics, we tend to sort of naively think of space, we think of the universe, we think of space as a container within which the universe happens, right? But actually, from the point of view of physics, space is created by matter and by the energies in the universe when the universe is expanding. So again, the Buddhist understanding of these elements is very much in line with the modern scientific understanding. When we're calling these elements, I've had some discussion with Ajahn Brahmali about this in recent weeks, and so one of the problems is that they don't quite mean the same as elements as we mean in like the chemical elements in the periodical table. Although the elements in the periodic table don't actually mean elements either, quite in that way sense. But they're not elements as in basic building blocks. Okay, that's not what we mean by elements. Of course, even in the periodic table, really, it's not basic building blocks, because those elements are also made up of smaller particles and so on. But in Buddhism, even though we use the word elements, they're perhaps better considered as properties. Right? So they're different kind of properties that matter has. And that way of thinking about the elements in a more abstract way, okay, so that they're given concrete names, earth, water, air, and fire, and they're obviously, you know, conceived in that concrete way in many places, but also that way of looking at them more in a more abstract sense as representing the properties of solidity, liquidity, the gaseous property and the heat property, that's also found within the suttas themselves, right? That's not just an interpretation or something, that's explicitly how they are defined within the early texts. And so we find these teachings on the elements taught in a number of very interesting suttas, especially in the Majjhima Nikaya. The Dhatuvibhanga Sutta is one of my favorite suttas of all, and that's Majjhima 140, if I remember the name number correctly. Majjhima 140, the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta is my favorite one, but there's also many other suttas, the Bahu Dhatuka Sutta. It talks about many kinds of elements and so on. But one passage that I'd like to read out for today, which is, I think, very interesting and relevant for reasons that hopefully will become apparent, and this is from the Mahahatipadopama Sutta. Okay, the Mahahatipadopama Sutta. So does anybody want to tell me what that means in English? Oh, very good. Excellent. Okay, that's very impressive. Okay, the greater discourse on the elephant's footprint. Okay. Yeah, that's right. You get a gold star.
Excellent.
I saw
that recently.
Sure. What's the number? 28. Close.
pretty close.
That's the chula of the Copan Matters 27.
Okay, so the word for, one of the words, is actually quite a lot of words for elephant in Pali, but one of the words for elephant that's used most commonly is hati. And the word hati is easy to remember because it's from the same root as the English word hand. Okay, so the elephant is the handy one because he's got his hand that he can grab things with. Okay, so that's why the elephant's called hati, because it's handy. There you go, there's one Pali word for this morning. Okay. So in the Maha Hatipadokama Sutta, it's just a very incredible Sariputta. It's quite an interesting structured sutta and gives a very good, nice insight into the very systematic way that the Sariputta approached the Dhamma. Begins by saying, just as the footprint of any living being that walks can be placed inside an elephant's footprint, and so the elephant's footprint is declared the chief of them because of its great size, so too all Kusala Dhammas, all skillful Dhammas, can be included in the Four Noble Truths. He then goes on to talk about Four Noble Truths, and then says, well, what's the Noble Truth? Suffering, birth is suffering, aging, suffering, and so on. And then the five aggregates are suffering, and then and what are the five aggregates? And it goes on the form, feeling, perception, and so on, and then says, well, what's the material form aggregate? Okay, what's Rupa Khanda? It's the four great elements and material form derived from the four great elements. What are the four great elements? Earth element, water element, fire element, and earth element. And then the rest of the sutta basically goes on to talk about these elements, not elephants, but elements, in more detail. Okay? So you see what he's done, he basically starts off by saying, here's one picture of the Dhamma, it's like an elephant's footprint. Why? Because it's like the Four Noble Truths, and then we'll hone in on this Four Noble Truth, and we'll hone in on that part of that Four Noble Truth, and then we'll hone in on that part of the definition, and then we'll take that out and we'll expand that, and then the whole of the sutta becomes about that one little detail in there. So it's very kind of very nice way he's introduced it and put the whole thing in the context. Anyway, so then goes on to talk about the different elements. And I'll just read through these definitions because they give you a nice variety of different ways of understanding and looking at and approaching the elements, not all of which might be completely obvious. So what, for instance, is the earth element? The earth element may be either internal or external. What's the internal earth element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. Okay, so notice here that those abstract definitions of the earth element are being introduced, as I mentioned earlier. And it says clung to, okay? This is a technical term in Buddhism. The Pali word is upadinna. Clung to is not a particularly transparent translation, but it's not an easy term to translate particularly straightforward way, but one way of translating it might be organic. Anyway, we'll think about that. What it means is that this is the earth element which has arisen because of dependent origination, because we've grasped at it, and because we've got ourselves a body in this life. Okay, that's what clung to means. It means that it's arisen because of grasping, i.e. it's our body, our organic body, if you like. Organic isn't very good, but anyway. Okay, so that is head hairs, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidney, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, consciences, stomach, feces, or whatever else, internally belonging to oneself, is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is called the internal earth element. Okay, now, so here, notice that it's defining the internal earth element in terms of the solid parts of the body. Alright? So, obviously, that's making explicit what should be fairly obvious anyway, is that these different practices that we're talking about are not all that different. Okay? So when we're looking at this, obviously a lot of overlap between these different things. I mean, when we're doing breath meditation, for example, we're also contemplating the air element, right? So these things, they always kind of overlap. And again, this is why this idea that through the observation of the body, we're looking at different aspects of the body. Right? It's the same thing that we're looking at, but we're looking at it in slightly different ways. Okay, now so this is the internal earth element. Now both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. And that should be seen So notice that we're here. So that it doesn't, in this particular passage, it's not defining the external earth element, but what it's doing is it's reducing or synthesizing those two. So the internal and the external are simply earth element. So again, that process where the boundaries of identity are being broken down. And that should be seen with proper wisdom, thus this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the earth element. Okay? So that's that process. And notice how here it's emphasizing the wisdom aspect, right? So you're seeing it through insight and you're seeing it through not self. Right? So there's a connection between seeing the earth element and seeing the not self. Now there comes a time when the water element is disturbed and the external earth element vanishes. Okay? When even this external earth element, as great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance and change, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. Okay, so again, very powerful passage there, right? So the water element is disturbed, i.e. there's a flood, right? The earth disappears, right? That's what this is talking about. It's talking about there is a time in the world when the external earth element disappears. So then, if others abuse, revile, scold and harass a bhikkhu who's seen this element as it actually is, he understands thus, this painful feeling born of ear contact has arisen in me. Okay? So notice this kind of shift in the topic. This is, I think, an unexpected, you know, development here. But it's talking about quite another aspect of the elements practice. Right? So if you're practicing in that way, someone abuses you, and then you reflect, this painful feeling born of ear contact has arisen in me. This is dependent, not independent. Dependent on what? Dependent on contact. He sees that contact is impermanent, that feeling is impermanent, that perception is impermanent, that sankharas, intentions and choices are impermanent, and that consciousness is impermanent. And his mind, having made an element its support, enters into that and acquires confidence, steadiness and resolution. Okay, now that last passage, again, it's a little bit difficult to pass idiomatically, but what it means is that having developed this meditation on the elements, then you can use that meditation on the element in order to deepen your practice in those other contexts, and then you can have that the confidence and so on that arises from that. Now, if others attack that bhikkhu in ways that are unwished for, undesired and disagreeable, by contact with fists, clods, sticks or knives, he understands thus, this body is of such a nature that contact with fists, clods, sticks and knives assail it. But this has been said by the Blessed One in his advice on the simile of the sword. Because even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled sword, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Okay? So, tireless energy shall be aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness established. My body shall be tranquil and undisturbed, my mind in samadhi and unified. Now let contact with fists and clods and sticks and knives assail this body, for this teaching of the Buddhas is being practiced by me. When that bhikkhu thus recollects the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, if equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in him, then he arouses a sense of urgency thus, it is a loss for me, it is no gain for me, it is bad for me, it's no good for me that when I recollect the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in me. Okay? So again, in a slightly unusual idioms in English, but I think the meaning is clear enough, that you're practicing in this way, you recollect the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and yet still you experience anger and so on, you can't have that wholesome equanimity.
Just as when a daughter-in-law sees her father-in-law, she arouses a sense of urgency to please him. Right? Yeah?
Modern times, eh? Okay. She arouses a sense of urgency to please him. So true. When that bhikkhu thus recollects the Buddha Dhamma Sangha equanimity that is supported by the wholesome does not become established, and he arouses a sense of urgency. But if, when he recollects the Buddha Dhamma Sangha equanimity supported by the wholesome does become established in him, then he is satisfied with it. At that point, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. Okay? So, you can see how this is, you know, such a very interesting teaching, yeah? And see how Sariputta is, he's gone so deeply into like one little point in the Dhamma, right? He's taken that apart, and it's developed, and he's found so many things that are very rich in there, and so many things that are really worthwhile. You know, and it's interesting to compare that with say, some of the discussions that we have on a retreat like this, you know? You see how we talk about a particular meditation, and see how it draws out all of these different topics, right, that people, you know, come up with and so on and so forth. And actually, Sariputra is doing a very similar thing here, right? Saying it's not just about, you know, looking at that element, but it's also how do you see not self? How do you cope when you're being abused or attacked? How do you deal with all of these different situations? And so that practice actually has so many implications which you know, address all of these different aspects. And so if you can practice in that way, much has been done. That's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah? So this is, you know, and this is that very kind of challenging teaching, right? So, any questions on the earth element before we go on? I've got more things to say about this, but I want to just go through the elements before giving some more reflections on it. Any other thoughts on that specifically? Sorry, could you speak up a little? Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. Okay, so the question is whether there's different aspects of like softness, hardness, and roughness and so on, which also part of that practice of the earth element. Well, I guess if we understand the earth element as the element of solidity or hardness, then generally speaking, in Buddhist theory of the elements, it's generally taught that that all of those elements are essentially always present. Okay, so it's not like there's, you know, this is a bit of earth element and this is a bit of water element and so on, but that all matter, in a sense, has those things present, but they might predominate or relate to each other in different kinds of ways. So just as if I, you know, this water has a certain quantity of heat in it, and if I heat it up, the heat gets more. If I cool it down, the heat is less. But it's not as if it doesn't have any heat. It's always got heat in there. So it's the same thing with all of the other elements. So like softness and hardness would be just a sort of a greater or lesser predominance of the earth element. You know, or maybe like the balance of the earth element and the water element and so on and so forth. So these would be, you know, part of that meditation, and you sort of see what the different qualities are. Of course, when you're talking in this way, it's only a generalization, okay? And matter comes in all kinds of different forms, and the way that energies move and things like that happens in all kinds of different ways. We know, you know, I said before that this, you know, corresponds with our scientific understanding, but we also know from science that matter exists in lots of other forms. More exotic forms that aren't included in the four elements, like plasma, for example, or various kinds of exotic matter that happen inside black holes and things like that. So it's not really meant to be, in that way, a comprehensive theory of matter, but more about how we experience the physical world. Right? So we experience those qualities or those properties. And that experience happens both, as it says, both internally and externally. Part of our meditation, we learn to discern what those different properties are. And as you discern those properties, you basically have two stages, like in the meditation, where we have many stages, but two stages are important, where firstly, where you can see what those individual properties are, right? So you can meditate and you actually discern what those elements are. So that's similar to what we were doing last night with the bones meditation, right? You actually just go in and you try to get a perception of what those bones are, right? You get a feel for what they are. So in that way you're discerning that aspect of the earth element, right? But in another way, it's another sort of a deeper level, which we didn't go into, was to then see how they relate to each other, okay? And so you see actually how all these different parts of the body and these different elements all connect with each other, and they all support each other and so on and so forth. And so that's why that there are many different deepening aspects to the practice. Okay? Yeah. Alright. Let's have a look at the water element. So what, friends, is the water element? The water element may either be internal or external. The internal water element, whatever internally belonging to yourself, is water, watery, and clung to. That is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spit, snot, oil of the joints, urine, or whatever else internally belonging to yourself is water, watery, and clung to. This is the internal water element. Now, both the internal water element and the external water element are simply water element, and that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the water element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the water element. Now there comes a time when the external water element is disturbed. It carries away. Remember, this is similar to what it said in the previous one. It said the water element is disturbed and the earth element disappears. But here it goes into more detail. The water element is disturbed, it carries away villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean sink down 100 leagues, 200 leagues, 300 leagues, 400 leagues, 5, 6, 700 leagues. So a league is a yojana, it's about 7 kilometers. So 700 leagues is what? 49,000 kilometers, which I think is quite a bit deeper than the actual ocean is. Anyway, we'll just skip over that little detail. Okay, they come to very deep. The ocean is very deep, okay? There comes a time when the waters of the great ocean stand 7 palms deep, 6 palms deep. So 7, these are palm trees, not palms of the hand. Okay? There comes a time when the waters in the ocean stand 7 fathoms deep. Fathom being, I think this measure here, the elbow to the fingertips. And there comes a time when the water is only a fathom deep. There comes a time when the water in the ocean is only half a fathom, waist deep, knee deep, ankle deep. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean are not enough even to wet the joint of a finger. When this external water element, as great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. And then the passage goes on to talk about the dealing with abuse and attacks and so on in the same way. Questions on the water element before we go on? We'll come back to talk more later, but just any... Okay, what, friends, is the fire element? Fire element may be either internal or external. What's the internal fire element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and organic. That is, that by which one is warmed, ages, and is consumed, and that by which what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to. That is called the internal fire element. Okay? So notice what's considered to be the fire element is not only the obvious fire element is the feeling of warmth in the body, which is that's the most obvious example, but it's also associated with aging. Okay, so the fire element is associated with the aging, and of course that's very true, isn't it? Right, we if you want to preserve things and make them last longer, you remove the fire element, i.e., you stick them in the fridge. Okay. And if you spend a lot of time in the fire element, for example, by going out and sunbathing all day, every day, then your skin will age much quicker. Yeah? So this is what's happening and what's, of course, going on. What heat actually is heat is really just an acceleration of motion of the atoms and molecules and so on. And generally speaking, it speeds up all of the reactions and chemical processes and so on, which is why it accelerates the aging process. So it's associated with aging, but it's also associated with digestion. Okay, so that which is, you know, there's almost this idea that when you eat food that's like cooked in your belly, and so that's what the digestion process is. And of course, that's also something which you can observe yourself, that when you're digesting food and so on, that your body tends to heat up. Especially, of course, if you're in India when you're eating spicy food. Okay. So the internal element and the external element, simply fire element, you see that as it really is. Now there comes a time when the external fire element is disturbed. It burns up villages, towns, cities, districts and countries. It goes out due to lack of fuel only when it comes to green grass or a rock or a road or a rock or water or to a fair open space. There comes a time when they seek to make a fire even with a cock's feather or a hide paring. When this external fire element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance and change, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So here again it's talking about states of imbalance, just as in the previous one I talked about the water element either becomes too much, yeah, and you have floods and it sweeps away all the different places, or it's not enough, and the oceans recede. The same thing with the fires, that can either become excessive, you can have flames and bushfires everywhere, or else the fire element recedes. And of course we know historically that the earth goes through periods of great cold, we call ice ages, and I can imagine that if you're a caveman or tribesman or something like that, and you're trying to light a fire and it's an ice age and you're out there in the freezing cold, and you're probably like, where is this fire element gone? Yeah? And this is very, you know, this is something, remember that these things which, you know, which in a sense our mastery of the natural world has come a long way, and we tend to take these things for granted, okay? But in the ancient world, and the world that the Buddha is just emerging from, fire is a god. In fact, fire is perhaps the most powerful of all the gods, right? And fire is that which enables civilization, right? It enables you to turn raw food into cooked food. It enables you to survive in cold climates, right? It enables you to, and this was something which was just happening shortly before the Buddha, was that their mastery of fire had improved in ancient India, so that they were able to, for the first time, smelt steel or iron, and to make very fine ceramics and fired bricks. Actually, they had fired bricks 1,000 years before in India, but they lost the technology for a long time. And it was around the time of the Buddha that they gradually started using those again. And you still see that today if you're travelling around India. You know, you see the brick kilns are still everywhere, and that technology was developed around the time of the Buddha or shortly after. So that mastery of fire is what makes civilization possible. Yeah? And it enables us to transform matter from one state into another. Okay. What, for instance, is the air element? The air element may be either internal or external. What is the internal air element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to. That is, upgoing winds, like burping. Downgoing winds, the other thing. Winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs, in-breath and out-breath. Or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to. This is called the internal air element. Now both the internal air element and the external air element are simply air element. And that should be seen with proper wisdom as not selves. There comes a time when the external air element is disturbed. It sweeps away villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries.
there comes a time in the last month of the hot season when they seek wind by means of a fan or bellows, and even the strands of straw in the drip fringe of the thatch do not stir. Again, these kind of two states of imbalance that we need to live with the earth element, that it can't be too much or too little. When even this external air element is seen to be impermanent, then how, what of this internal earth air element? Then at that point, much has been done by that bhikkhu. So then the Buddha goes on, I'll just mention this briefly, I won't go into the whole sutta, but then briefly the next section says, friends, just as when a space is enclosed by timber and creepers, grass and clay, it comes to be termed just a house, so too when a space is enclosed by bones and sinews, flesh and skin, it comes to be termed just material form or rupa. Okay, so this is one of the passages I was referring to earlier when I said that in the suttas the concept of space is something which is derived from the other, the relationship between the other elements. Okay, space is not something that exists in and of itself, but it's what they call upadaya rupa. As you remember from the beginning, it said that the rupa khanda, the aggregate of material form, is these four great elements and derived materiality. Okay? And so space is one of those forms of derived materiality, not something that exists in itself, but something that arises out of a relationship between the other elements, just as space in a house only exists because of the walls and roof and so on of that house. Okay. Questions? Comments?
Why is the brain in this whole physical?
Why is there no brain?
Given how important when we get to the principles of balance, the contact.
They knew that there was a brain, yeah, they didn't know that it was a brain. Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, it is a curious omission. It sometimes says that the brain was considered to be a kind of bone marrow. But I'm not sure whether that's correct or not, because what you find is, of course, in the later lists, this is the early list of the 31 parts of the body, very, very shortly afterwards, in the late canonical period, you find the list of 32 parts of the body, which has the brain added to it. So yeah, it's quite curious why in those earliest lists it has the brain missing. I'm not sure why that is.
And how much later do you know
about? Very shortly. And even in Pali Kudika Nikaya, you find the brain is added to the list. Yeah, so probably around the time of Ashoka or a bit later. Yeah, so I mean the fact that it was added in there so quickly seems that other people noticed the omission. They're like, hang on, what have I forgotten about the brain? That's awkward, isn't it? Maybe we're just going to slip it in there and no one notices. I really don't know. It's a curious thing. So I don't quite know why that is the case. Yeah.
So where did they think all this? So we've got this sort of contact leading to the feeling and all of that. Where did they think that's happening in the body? Where did they think it was not happening in the body?
Well, the position of the suttas is that all of these things happen in relation to the body. Okay? So there's always that condition, yachakucha paticha rupecha upajata chakavinyana, depending on I am form as arises I consciousness. So these things are always happening in relation to the body, but it doesn't really go into any more detail exactly about what's meant by that. Okay? So you just say the I without actually specifying it in any more detail. In the Abhidhamma, and especially in the commentaries, does go into more detail, and the theory that it develops there is that you have a thing that they call pasada rupa, which is like a Sadarupa means something like clear matter, like a form of subtle matter that's like transparent matter, something like that. Which is the sensitive surface that's the interface between sense stimuli and consciousness, and that pasada rupa is like a tiny little speck that's included in the eye or in the different sense organs. Yeah. I mean, it's not completely dissimilar from the modern idea that you have, the specialized sensitive nerves and whatever, than the eye that's actually receiving the light. So I mean, I don't think it's an identical concept, but it's not that dissimilar. Yeah.
I was just astonished that the Buddha should have understood so clearly,
right,
that the sort of physical realm of experience has made up. And yet, there's nothing that suggests that, okay, I suspect in the most people should follow, people regard the mind as the situation in the brain,
right,
which is largely being suspended.
Yeah.
But there's nothing that I've seen so far that suggests that there was any concern that this is remembering this thought, whether it was held in the brain or whether it was held throughout the body. And I'm just curious.
His
understanding and profound wisdom is really being such a points as a maturation.
No. What I think one of the things that's interesting about the suttas is that they have a very unobvious but very subtle sense of the limits to which they go in talking about these things. Right? So for example, something like the way that we're talking about matter here, right? It talks about it enough so you get a very clear idea of exactly what he's talking about. But he doesn't like overcommit to a particular theory of what matter is. Right? Of course, in the Abhidhamma commentaries, then those limits were kind of let go of, and they tried to specify these things in as much detail as possible. And so what you find is that in some cases, those specifications are actually very interesting and very insightful. But in other cases, they're quite absurd, and they're just completely wrong in the way that they understand many different kinds of physical attributes, right? I mean, just to give you one example of that, in the suttas it has this kind of concept of, which is mentioned a few times, called ojar, okay? And ojar is just a kind of a general term meaning something like nutrition, okay? So it's like that part of food which makes you, gives you nutrition. And the sort of just, it's just not a technical term, it's just referred to a few times that there's this ojar, which is nutrition and food. But in the Abhidhamma, ojar becomes one of the ultimate realities, right? So that matter has ojar as it's like a fundamental property of matter, is nutrition, okay? Of course, it's completely absurd. We know that nutrition isn't a fundamental property of matter. It's a higher order concept, higher order property that emerges from complex combinations of chemicals and so on and so forth. So there's many ways in which the later tradition has overextended itself in applying these ideas, whereas in the suttas there's a much more stick to the things which you can experience and stick to the things that are going to matter, and kind of the general way of looking at things. This is my feeling. If you look at a lot of these things, it's difficult. Bhikkhu Bodhi made this point many years ago. He said that, we should be, even though it's true to say that Buddhism in many ways is very scientific, and that, most of the findings of Buddhism as far as they go, or certainly in early Buddhism, are very much in harmony with what we know from science, given, allowance for the different perspectives. But he said we should be cautious about sort of hitching our wagon to any particular scientific theory, not least because scientific theories change quite a lot, right? One good example of that would be in cosmology, right? In Buddhist cosmology, you have like the expansion and contraction of the universe. And, a few decades ago, that was very much in line with the Western scientific cosmology, right? The Big Bang and the Big Crunch. But these days, they tend to think that there's not going to be a big crunch, there's going to be a big rip instead. And so what does that mean? Does that mean that agrees with the Buddhist cosmology, or that we have to interpret it differently? So, yeah, it's just one of those things where you have to, you know, I think it's fine to sort of reflect on the similarities and differences, but just to be a little bit cautious about saying, oh yeah, this is this, you know, the Buddha was talking about this and that's what that is, you know, once you start to go down that road, I think you're kind of a little bit missing the point. Yeah, but hopefully there's like a meeting ground. You know, I'd like to think of it more in terms of there being a possibility for a meeting ground in the dialogue rather than an equivalence.
That's right, yeah. And everyone's going, oh, go on, tell us. Exactly, yeah. Absolutely. The purpose of Dhamma, obviously the purpose of Dhamma is different from the purpose of science, right? And this is something that's also important to bear in mind. One similarity between Buddhism and science is that we both have a pragmatic attitude towards truth, right? So from a scientific point of view, the truth that's right is the truth that's good enough in terms of what you want to achieve, right? And same thing with Buddhism, the truth that's right is the truth that gets you liberated. So that's, and so because you're coming at it from different perspectives, then sometimes you may, you know, may talk about it in different ways or emphasize different aspects and so on and so forth, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's contradictory.
And also, it means that sometimes I can come from the
background.
So I
think that's a compelling argument to broaden that.
Oh, I agree. If I might play devil's advocate just for a moment, there was a study that came out a couple of years ago that they took people onto retreat, and they said, you know, at the end of the retreat, then they had, you know, reductions in anxiety and stress and things like that. So that was really good. The control group was a group of people who went to a spa and chilled out and had massages and slept in all day. And they had similar reductions in anxiety and stress after a few days.
How long did it last?
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm sure that my own feeling on that would be that, of course, because it depends on your methodology and what you're looking for, that the Buddhist practice also, as well as reducing your stress, incidentally also gets you enlightened and other stuff, which probably going to a spa isn't going to do. So right there, but the point is simply that yes, the scientific method is important, and you know, as you know, we did our own sort of fairly modest scale research into a couple of the meta retreats we did a couple of years ago with Beatrice. And that was a very interesting process for all of us to do. And we did a survey of the people on the retreat, and we chose Beatrice chose a sort of accepted scale of like compassion and understanding and so on. And we did surveys. We did one retreat here in Sydney and one in Perth, and we did the surveys of people and tried to follow up as best we could. Beatrice got that published in a nice peer-reviewed journal and things like that. And I was very happy to see the other day one of Venerable Analio's recent articles that he's actually citing Beatrice's study on metta. Yeah? So that's very nice, isn't it? Yeah? So we're all kind of going around. And I mean, I think that we should be doing kind of more work like that. But, you know, we also understand that it has limitations, that's all. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another thing that really became so clear to me when I did that, actually participated in that survey. Right? You seem like, you've got a bunch of questions and people have to tick these boxes about what their experiences were during the retreat and things like that. But at the same time, I was doing the interviews for the people in the retreat. Right? And so what you're hearing in the interviews, right, is so much more complex and richer and nuanced. Right? And you're hearing all of these stories and all of these backgrounds, and so varied, right? To try to reduce, right, what you're hearing in those interviews, right, to a bunch of a checklist. Yeah, it was so different. And of course, even what I'm hearing in the interviews is itself only a small fraction of the experiences that people are having on the retreat. And so you realize that, doing that method, yes, you're capturing something, but you're only capturing a tiny slice of the reality. So when we did our panel on climate change a couple of weeks ago, one of the things that was very striking for me was to hear from Auntie Frances Bodkin, who spoke both as an Aboriginal elder and also as a biologist. And she pointed out that in the Aboriginal mythology they have this idea that she's done these studies on Aboriginal mythology and trying to see what kind of physical, actual sort of geological reality that some of these things might correspond to. And she said that in a number of stories they told of this great river at this certain place, and there's sort of a mighty river that, I think that she said it took two days to row across it or something like that. But there's no river there, right? When you go there today, there's no river. And she said that the geologists have sort of discovered that tens of thousands of years ago, in fact, there was a very, very wide river at that place. And so that memory has been passed down in the stories for such a long time. It's quite incredible, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And she's saying that they have this idea of these different kind of cycles that the earth goes through. And they're very similar to those cycles that we just read about in the sutta, where you have like the cycle of fire, where, the earth becomes very dry and very hot for a period of time, and then you have like a watery cycle or a cold cycle and so on. And those things happen over periods of maybe tens of thousands of years. And she said that talking in the context of climate change today is that process has been sort of so greatly accelerated. And, when you read some of those descriptions in there, and you think, my goodness, that's exactly what's happening to our world today. And it talks about how the fire element goes completely out of control. If you've been following the news recently, you see in many parts of the world, but especially in Alaska and northern Canada at the moment, the bushfire situation is completely out of control. It's not somewhere that we normally associate with sort of wildfire problems because of the coal, but it's just unbelievable. There's fumes of smoke which are now covering large parts of North America and coming from these wildfires which are worse than at any time in history. One of the ironies of it is that the firefighters are all, the firefighting budget is supplied by the revenues from the oil industry. Right? So this is what's causing the climate change, which is causing the wildfires. It's like the hottest winter or hottest summer or whatever they're having. It must be summer. And the fires have been so devastating that they're exposing the permafrost from the tundra, and that of course is then creating a much greater risk of the tundra then catching fire, and also creating a risk of the emitting CO2 and carbon monoxide from that, and thus more feedback and accelerating that process. So these things just get out of control, out of balance. So that whole region in the past was a CO2 sink, and in all of the climate change modelling and so on, it's been assumed that would be a CO2 sink, but now it's actually on the brink of becoming an emitter of CO2, not a sink of it. And so this is how these elements are going out of balance. And also the water element is also dangerously out of balance at the moment. So these things are not just happening one by one, but they're all happening at the same time. And just on the day before we came on retreat, I don't know if anybody saw that article, but
but there was a article published in the journal Science by what's her name, Alison somebody? I can't remember her name. Anyway, a bunch of scientists, and they had reviewed literature on sea level rise, and they'd gone back as far as 3 million years to look at what had happened when the temperature had risen and what happened to the sea level rise. And of course, the reason you go back 3 million years is because that's how far you have to go back to find climate conditions that are similar to the ones we're facing already or that we're going to be facing soon. And they found that consistently over that period that a temperature rise of 2 degrees, so remember that 2 degrees is supposed to be the safe limit, okay? So 2 degrees is like, let's try and keep it under 2 degrees. Of course, there's no way we're going to keep it under 2 degrees, but let's assume that that's somehow a meaningful limit. And under the IPCC projections, that means we're going to have a sea level rise of roughly 90 centimeters by the end of the century. Okay, so 90 centimeters is cataclysmic. It means several nations will disappear. It means tens of millions of people will be displaced. It means so many terrible things will happen. And that's the moderate projections of the IPCC. And this new report is saying that under a 2 degrees temperature rise, we can expect sea level rise of 6 meters. That's 6 meters. And they're saying they don't know what the time frame is, but it could be decades. Right? Now that's just gobsmacking finding. It's one of the most terrifying findings I've read in all my years of reading the research on climate change. 6 meters means that, among other things, it means that there'll be close to 500 million people whose homes will be underwater. Yeah? 100 million in China. 36% of Vietnam will be underwater. Sorry? Yeah, forget about the Maldives, yeah. Yes, yeah. And so many major world cities will be underwater, yeah. Miami, Florida, Perth will be gone. I think Sydney might survive to some degree because it's up on the sandstone, but most of the other Australian cities will be gone. And tens of millions of people displaced in Bangladesh, in India, in Thailand, and so on, all around our region. So this is what now predicted to happen with the moderate, safe 2 degrees limit, the 2 degrees limit, which is in fact completely unrealistic. And there was no sane scenario in the IPCC report that actually resulted in a 2 degree temperature rise. Okay? It doesn't exist. To keep it under 2 degrees, basically all of the world's governments and all of the world's corporations and everybody has to get together and immediately do everything they possibly can in order to stop climate change. Right? That's what's necessary to keep it under 2 degrees. And so it's obviously not going to happen. Same day in the news, we hear that our wonderful government has now decided to remove the support for solar energy from the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. Right? I mean, it's just madness. What we're doing is just madness. And we think that we can live in this way. And we think that, you know, we have this arrogance to think that we can control the outcome. I spoke to Tony Abbott personally about this, and he personally said to us as a group of delegates talking about climate change, Australia can cope with a 1 meter sea level rise without too much problem. That's what he actually said. Well, they're listening to all these nut jobs like Lord Monckton and all of these kinds of people, yeah. So, yeah, who knows where they get their information from. Yeah? And all of these things are, you know, there's this kind of In the suttas, in this particular sutta, it doesn't really talk about the reasons for these things, right? It talks about the impermanence of them and that they change. But elsewhere in the suttas, in the Aghanya Sutta and other places, it specifically says that these elements and so on go out of balance because of human activity. Right? It's not just, they don't just decide one day to do these things. They do because of human greed. Right? Because we overconsume, because we treat the environment like crap. And just like if you treat your internal earth element like crap, right? What's going to happen? Right? And if you stuff yourself full of junk food and all of this kind of thing, of course, yeah, you know what the result is. It's cause and effect. It's the same thing we do to our external environment. It's just cause and effect. And so we've created a situation where our external environment, all of those elements, they are out of balance. Yeah? This is not just a theory. You know, we've seen this year more, nearly 2,000 people died of heat in India and Pakistan. Hmm? 2,000 people. I'm not, you just can't encumber that. How could it be? And, you know, but things like Typhoon Hainan and the drought in California, again, you know, the water element out of balance, the air element out of balance, everything going out of balance. And so, I, you know, this is something I've talked about on many occasions, and I try to bring up, and I think we need to talk about it, we need to reflect on it. I don't have any answers. If you want, then you're most welcome to take the standard Buddhist approach and say, oh, well, it's all impermanent anyway, I'm just going to go off and meditate and be happy. Okay, and I can't blame you for wanting to do that. Okay, it seems like a perfectly reasonable response to the situation. And at the very least, if you do that, you're probably not going to make things much worse. Okay, at least you're going to be content and stuff like that. I think that's not an unreasonable approach. I do think, and we just discussed this yesterday a little bit with Leslie's question, we talked about that kind of social implications of it. Yeah? And so, you know, in the sutta, you know, it is always talking about the internal and the external, right? It's not just internal. Obviously, in meditation and on a meditation retreat, we're focusing mainly on those contemplative and internal aspects. But these things are never completely separated. When we are breathing in this air. We are breathing in this CO2, and there is not a single breath that you take from now until the time you die. There's not a single breath which has not been altered by human activity. There's not a single breath that you will take that doesn't have chemicals in it that are the result of industrial output. There's not a single breath that you take that doesn't have higher levels of CO2 in it because of human activity. So our body, our climate change is not something that's just external to us. It's happening in our own bodies right now. Every time we breathe, we are literally breathing in climate change. So my hope and my, you know, my encouragement for everybody is that you know, this is something we need to consider, we need to reflect on, we need to get ready, we need to think about what it means and what choices we want to make for ourselves and for our families and for our futures. But it's also something that I encourage people to try to do what you can about it. Is the situation hopeless? Probably. Probably not what you want to hear, but I'm just being honest. If what we can do, at the very least what we can do, and it's not a small thing, what we can do is we can reduce or delay or minimize the impact. Right? So even if we can't avoid the catastrophes that are looming, you know, we can make them no worse than they need to be. We can make the environment no more damaged than it needs to be. So at the very least, we can try to do what we can. And, you know, we do have the privilege that we are born in a democratic society, and a society where we still do have freedom of speech. That freedom is not an absolute freedom. We've seen in a few years ago in Canada, the government passed a gag order on its government scientists, essentially saying that they couldn't depart from the government line when talking on climate issues and other relevant issues. And so when the Abbott government came into power, this is what I was expecting them to do, was to introduce these similar kinds of gag orders, and we've seen that's exactly what they've done with the asylum seekers and the doctors looking after the asylum seekers. And I would expect that if they stay in power, we'll see the same thing for the scientists in government employ, that there'll be gag orders as well. They won't be able to speak out. But for now, we have freedom of speech. We can say what we like, okay? We're not going to get thrown in jail. Yes? And even if you are, so what? All right? And, you know, I know people who have gone and risked being thrown in jail, including my good friend Thea from ARC. And, you know, Thea is a, you know, she's a 60 or something year old Catholic housewife. She's not a kind of hippie or anyone you'd expect to be in that situation. Her husband's a respected Catholic theologian and thing. And she's up there at Moores Creek getting herself arrested, trying to stop the coal mines from happening. And she said to me, you know, she sees all the feral kids up there, you know, putting their lives on the line, and she's saying, you know, they're not religious, but they're the best Christians that I know. And so I think it's important for all of us to ask what can we do? And I'm sure that you know, most people here are probably doing what you can, small things we can do, you know, make sure that we use renewable electricity and all of these kinds of things. But also, you know, to make sure that we have our voice, and to make sure that the voice of the Buddhist community, or the voice of the voice of wisdom. And I don't care whether anyone's Buddhist or not, but when we're practicing Dhamma and we're practicing meditation, we do have some wisdom. And when you reflect, you have some space in your mind for meditation, you do have wisdom. And everybody in this room is a wise person, okay? And you might not think of yourself in that way, okay? But, you know, I don't know, go and hang out in the shopping mall in Parramatta for a little while and listen to what everyone's talking about, and you realize, actually, yeah, there's quite a lot of wisdom here, relatively speaking, yeah? And the reality is that most people, most of the time, we let ourselves get distracted by things that are very trivial and very nonsensical and very meaningless and these kinds of things. Yeah? And hopefully, you know, each of you can perform a role. Maybe it's just with your family and friends. Maybe it's at your workplace. Maybe it's through, you know, having a wider voice in society or whatever. But all of you have a voice that has some wisdom. Don't be afraid to use it. Okay? Don't let our society become impoverished because the voices of wisdom are too afraid to speak. Okay? So have some pride in that, and to try to do what you can to help. Yeah. Put it on my blog. I don't think I really need to. You can Google it easily. You've got a lot of press. I'll just find any blog or paper that talks about climate change, and they will have reported on it. There's a good article on Think Progress, thinkprogress.org. The climate section on that is one of the best. If you want to follow the issues on climate change, the climate section on thinkprogress.org is one of the best, and they're usually very up to date. But there's articles in The Guardian, and it was very widely reported. So, I think it's in the wet season that it'll flood,
But that doesn't flow all year round, yeah. Right. Right, yes, yeah. That's right, yeah. I know, yeah. And that's, you know, that's a huge deal, what happening with all of the Himalayan meltwater and everything, and this is another, you know, huge shift, and of course there are hundreds of millions of people dependent on that water. That's the most densely populated area in the world. Yeah, all through India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. Yes. I mean, even earlier than that, I thought you were going to mention that the river which dried up even long before the Buddha came was what do they call it? Oh, the name's escaping. Saraswati? I can't even remember now. I think Saraswati is a really big river in northwestern India, which it seems that was basis for the Indus Valley civilization, and it seems, based on the satellite imagery and so on, that's why the Indus Valley civilization collapsed again, was because of climate change, and that the river that they were all dependent on essentially dried up and split up into a number of sort of smaller rivers and so on. So that was happening maybe 1,000 years before the Buddha. Saraswati. Okay, so having discussed the cheerful topic of climate change, let's talk about decaying corpses. See how it's developed it then? It's a very smooth, smooth transition. All right, so we may be doing a lot more of this. Okay, so the child ground contemplations, and so monastic just as if they were to see a corpse thrown in the child ground. It's a slightly curious idiom to try to translate. Sayatapi basaya sariram. It seems to be mainly an imaginative exercise, right? So it doesn't mean you actually have to go to a cemetery to see it. So obviously, monastics would do that sometimes, but it's also something which was a very common sight. Okay, so they didn't have, they didn't have such an obsession with hiding death and so on, so that you know, it would be quite normal to see bodies, dead bodies around the place in the child grounds and so on. And they weren't all kind of neatly buried away like they are in our cemeteries. So you'd actually see the body there. So it's either an imaginative exercise, and you, based on your memory and perception of that, or you can actually go to the charnel ground and see it yourself. And there's a number of descriptions of that kind of meditation happening in the early suttas. Monastic, just as if they would see a corpse thrown in a charnel ground, dead for 1, 2, or 3 days, bloated, livid, and festering. They compare it with their own body. This body is also of that same nature, that same kind, and cannot go beyond this. In this way, they meditate by observing an aspect of the body internally and so on. So here we see once again that idea of that internal and external. And so again, the whole point of that is to move beyond it, right? See this body, evan dhammo, evan bhavo, etan namatitoti, evan dhammo. It says that same nature, the word here is dhamma. They are of that same dhamma, that same bhava, right? That same kind. And they cannot go beyond this. So it's not about sort of objectifying the body and saying that body is repulsive or anything like that, but it's about seeing that is the nature of this body, etan anatito, literally can't go past this, can't get, that's the nature of the body. It can't transcend that nature of decay. Of course, that's being put to the test these days. And as from a Buddhist point of view, we should of course be very pleased to see that Google has started an immortality project. Okay. So now Google is going to see, is this right or wrong, right? Maybe the Buddha was wrong, and actually the body can be, have the lifespan extended indefinitely, and maybe we can find the chemicals that cause aging and we can reverse them or something like that, or maybe we can grow replacement organs from stem cells and just kind of swap them out when they get old, okay? And so on and so forth. And this again is one of the things that we're looking at in the conference coming up. We have talking with Guy Benary, who's growing his own brain in a jar. So this might be something that we all do in the future, right? So you get some stem cells, yeah, and you can give them to a little laboratory, and then they can grow the stem cells into different kinds of cells. So you maybe grow like a vat of neurons and a vat of kidney cells and so on and so forth, a vat of muscle cells and things like that. And you keep them in the fridge, and then when you have an accident, yeah, then they can get the relevant cells out. Or if you have some disease or something like that, or maybe you've just been drinking too much, you need a new kidney or something like that, you've already got the cells prepared, you can get them out and use them to repair your old kidney or to get a new one or something like that. Yeah. Sound like fun? Yeah? Is it moving like that, isn't it? I'm sure there probably is, yeah. And this is a problem, you see, this is a problem. You can't do science fiction these days, because by the time you finish making the movie, it's already reality, right? Sorry? Sure, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I mean, start with simple things, and then you know, maybe bone marrow or something like that. Yeah. I mean, you can see, obviously, there would be great medical applications. I mean, if you could, you know, do that for, you know, kids with leukemia or bone marrow cancer or something like that and use it to exchange, there's always a shortage of these things. So, yeah. Yeah.
But the stem cell, I don't know how the stem cell works, right? My mother-in-law had cancer. He passed away in January, but he was part of the participant with the one of the Buddhist professors that doing the nanotechnology, which is stem cell.
Okay.
And one of the techniques specifically to use stem cell to replace your cell that being killed by cancer.
Okay.
Then the normal therapy is basically if you diagnose with cancer, you do a chemo. The chemo will kill everything.
Right.
And then after that, you use the stem cell to replace and rebuild it.
Okay.
Obviously, my mother-in-law didn't do the chemo, but among the groups that participate in the research,
okay,
do that first.
Okay.
And so far, there's about most of the cancer patients are still alive today.
Okay.
Some 5 years, 3 years, 5, 10, stuff like that.
Okay. Okay.
They're not in good shape, but they still alive.
Okay.
So that's quite
amazing.
Yeah. One thing that is dodgy in this, because when I'm in Indonesia, there's no like NDA or consent agreement. They just give you the. Yeah, the stem cell only lasts apparently 2 weeks.
Okay.
So every now and then there will be a new batch.
Okay.
Sent from America to the hospital.
Okay.
And at that point, we have to rush. Bring my mother-in-law contained in a hospital, do the stem cell treatment for 2 weeks.
Mm.
After that, more people.
Okay.
Just looking like that. We said that's it. You have to be stem cell, injected with stem cell.
Yeah.
To survive.
Right. Okay.
And the effect of the stem cell is already. So people are freezing all in the sun and stuff. Some will be burning hot.
Okay.
Different people, different.
The five people.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Huh?
That's something else. Yeah. And there's two ways of the grown stem cell. One is from the vegetable, one is from the animals.
Okay. Yeah.
Maybe you can offer that something with them.
Yeah. So Buddha always said that we should test his teachings out. Okay, so he's saying that we can't go beyond death, so we should test that out. And if Google can make us go beyond death, we'll have to say, okay, sorry Buddha, you were wrong. Okay. I suspect though that, I mean, you know, it's one thing about Google is they're a very fascinating company because, you know, what they've done is make a very nice search engine and a very nice email client and things. There's a fairly big leap from making a good email service to, like, immortality, you know. But that doesn't stop them from trying. So, anyway. Okay. Furthermore, a monastic just as if they would see a corpse in the thrown away in the charnel ground being eaten by crows, hawks, vultures, herons, dogs, tigers, leopards, jackals, and many kinds of little creatures. They compare it with their own body. This body is also of the same nature, the same kind, it cannot go beyond this. Just incidentally remarking on this, I haven't looked at it in detail, but the list of animals that's given here is quite different from the list of animals you'll find in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. If you have that to hand, that's, what does he say here? Here it says, list of animals is crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, and various kinds of worms. And no mentions of herons, tigers, leopards. Quite a significantly different list, and I'm not quite sure why that's the case. It's not a standard list like most lists, like the 32 parts and so on, are quite standard. This one is, I think, only found here. But yeah, I'm not exactly sure why Bhikkhu Bodhi's version has that, but that's, anyway, this is what it says in the Pali text I was using. Presumably he was using probably a Sinhalese manuscript as his primary source. So interesting. It's unusual to find that degree of variation between the manuscript tradition.
Why
do
this need
it
all? Why not just say animal?
Well, you could.
Why do? Is this for poetry, or is it any real purpose in having a least specific animal?
Sure, I don't think it really changes the meaning.
Yeah.
But it is quite vivid, though. Yeah, it brings it to mind. You think what it looks like. Herons I found interesting.
Herons eat
fish. Yeah, do herons go into the charnel ground and rip bodies apart?
Are they like the ibis?
Oh, maybe. Oh, maybe. Maybe it's like a Sydney ibis. Maybe I should just translate the ibis. So we can have like a little Sydney reference in there. We can sneak in without anybody noticing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they eat insects, frogs.
Right.
They even go for a mouse. But anything small, usually living things. I've never heard of heron feeding.
Yeah, carrion. Okay, so the next one. Just as if you would see a corpse thrown into charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews, or a skeleton without flesh but smeared with blood held together with sinews, a skeleton without flesh and blood held together by sinews, or bones without sinews scattered in every direction. Here a hand bone, there a foot bone, here a shin bone, there a thigh bone, here a hip bone, there a rib bone, here a back bone, there an arm bone, here a neck bone, there a jaw bone, here a tooth, there the skull. They compare it with their own body. Okay, so this is obviously just talking about the gradual decomposition of the skeleton and disappearance of the flesh and so on. Furthermore, a monastic, just as if they would see a corpse thrown in a charnel ground with white bones, the colour of shells. It's not a very kind of old... Bones more than a year old heaped in a pile, or even bones rotted and crumbled to dust.
They compare it with their own body. This body is of the same nature, the same kind, and cannot go beyond this. So we rarely get the chance to do these meditations these days, certainly in Australia. When we were in Thailand, it was not uncommon that you'd have a like a body being burnt in the monastery or something like that. And so we'd always go out and do some meditation meditation beside the funeral pyre. The worst part about it, which is something that's not in the thing, is because, you know, you have to sort of understand the context, right? So we're like in a forest monastery. So in the Thai forest tradition, then you only eat one meal a day, right? So you eat in the morning, and that's it. You don't have anything else to eat during the whole day. And then they do these funerals in the night time, right? In the evening, and usually in the afternoon, and they burn the bodies. And it smells just like a barbecue. So I've been vegetarian for years, right? You know, I'm not eating meat from barbecues, but there were a few tummy rumblings happening there. And all the dogs are coming around and trying to rip the body off and stuff like that. You can't help it. Well, why don't you go out at midnight and sit in the cemetery and do metta for all of the dead people and see if they come and pay you a visit. It's only like, you know, when you're actually doing it in the formal meditation. Doesn't mean you shouldn't have metta for the people who passed away, but just in the meditation, just be careful, because it can have the mixed feelings, because of grief and things like that can come up. Yeah. It doesn't mean you can't do it, it just means that's just a risk, so you can see. You can try it if you like. Maybe you might get some interesting, you know. We'd be very happy to hear the stories about what happened to you. I think it'd be more effective if you were alone. Well, hopefully, yeah. Hopefully they've kind of moved on. Well, yeah, but the Predator realm isn't like a different realm or something like that. It's still here.
I think it's an activation thought, because
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's an interesting detail, and I'm not entirely sure. Obviously, in some cases, they would cremate the body, and the Buddha was cremated, but it seems that wasn't always the case. The word is an interesting word that's used here. It's chagitam, and Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as something like thrown aside in a charnel ground. And the word chagita literally means something like that. So it's almost like a feeling like, you know, just like throwing out rubbish or something like that. Now, I was kind of reluctant to translate it that way. I think I've translated something like placed in a charnel ground or something more neutral. Because I find it unlikely that, I mean, no culture treats their dead like that, basically. Yeah? So I'm not entirely sure what's going on here. Is it the case that perhaps a charnel ground, sometimes it might only be used for essentially outcasts, you know, maybe like thieves, you know, people, criminals or something like that. They weren't given a proper burial and then the body was thrown in the charnel ground. Not entirely sure. In Thailand, for example, they'll always cremate the bodies, but if it's a violent death, like a suicide or murder victim or something like that, they'll actually bury them. So I'm not really sure whether that's the case here, but it may well be the case. So this is what you're saying is perhaps it's just people who, I don't know, didn't have anyone to do a funeral for them, right? Couldn't afford to do a set, to, you know, employ a priest and all the functionaries to do a proper funeral. Maybe they're from that one of the outcasts or something like that, or for whatever reason they were just thrown there.
Then
the Chinese talks
about Tibet, which I know you've talking about. It's broke, the ground's
frozen,
and they had to cut up the body.
Mm. And then the vultures come and take them out. It's actually originally Zoroastrian practice. Yeah, the Tibetans got it from the Zoroastrians, Parsis. Yeah. Children have floated down rivers.
In order to signify, yeah, up to the age of 9.
Cracky.
To signify it on the right next time. The high people.
I haven't done like a huge amount of it, and I wasn't in a place where they had like a decaying corpse or something. There have been cases where monks have done that, in where they've actually had the corpse that's fully decayed and they've gone and meditated with it. And that was done at a monastery not far from where I was at, but it was a few years before I was there. And then the monks took turns to sort of come and sit by the corpse during the night time, and so they all be there. Just they have to go alone, one at a time, and sit in the night time with the corpses decaying. They said the hardest part was the smell. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, it is still done, but yeah, fairly rarely. So you know what I've done, we would normally in the monasteries I was in, you do the cremations for the local village, right? So when somebody died, they would come and so it usually take about a day. It's the cremation's done outside. We had like a kind of a brick thing. It's just like two-sided brick structure, which was actually built by Ajahn Brahm, as it happens, when he was there. He built the brick thing. And they've now moved it, so it wasn't the front entrance of Mamachart when you drove in.
It was like you drove in and there's like a roundabout at the front of the monastery, and it was actually in the middle of that roundabout. But they've since moved it off to the side. So you just, the body would be placed there on some wood and sticks and things like that, and it would be burnt. And there'd be, you know, there's a reasonable amount of fuel on the fire, so it's quite hot. But you know, you can still see very clearly as the body's being burnt up and then sort of breaking up and the fat boiling off it and the different parts charring and things like that. So another time I saw it happening in a monastery in the south of Thailand. It's a monastery called Wat Tham Sira, which was a monastery of my god it'll come to me in a second. Anyway, I remember that very well because we were sitting in the hut with another monk, and somebody burst into the hut and said, "Do you want to see a burning dead nun?" So of course we're like, "Yeah, sure." That's literally what he said. "Do you want to see a burning dead nun?" So we went out, and so they're doing this funeral for one of the Meichis who had died in the monastery, and burning it. In that case, it was very interesting because even though it was a very kind of well-developed monastery, it was a big tourist monastery, and it had these big tourist buses coming up and so on. And they didn't have anything there; they just literally had like the car park, and she was just burning on a pile of sticks in the car park. And one of the things was like, if you're in Thailand, you see like all the monks and the nuns, they spend hours every day sitting in the puppy up position, like with their knees to one side. And it's like the kind of natural posture that they're in. So her knees sort of went back into that position when she was burning. And so, natural, I guess. Anyway, there was very little fire. Right, it was very, you know, just a few sticks and things like that, and they were burning. So we just sort of stood beside it and were doing the contemplation and so on. And it was also quite interesting because, like, the tourist buses were coming with all these Western tourists to come and visit the monastery. I thought, what is this? What is that? It is a burning dead nun. usually they'll collect up any bones and things like that, and they'll put them in a jar, and then they'll keep that in the temple. Yeah. Or they might put it in a little stupa or something like that. Yeah. You're just going to watch it, and when you're watching it, what you find is that if you contemplate it for a long time, that usually your mind, like there's a kind of a cool, first of all, there's like a coolness when you're contemplating. So that it's like a kind of a letting go of things. And there's this kind of fascination. And so the mind is kind of drawn, it's kind of interesting. You know, you're drawn into sort of look and contemplate the different aspects. And then there might be like one particular image, one particular thing. It might be like a particular bone or a particular piece of burnt flesh or something like that. And then that sort of grabs your mind, or your mind sort of latches onto that one particular image, and you can kind of stay with that. And then when you go back and you meditate afterwards, you can then bring that image up, or any image that sort of sticks in your mind from that, and then you can use that as a kind of nimitta and keep on recalling that. And then when that comes back, then the feeling that's associated with it, it's that kind of cool, kind of letting go feeling comes. And even though we think of it as something that's kind of repulsive or something like that, but yes, those feelings might come sometimes, but mostly the feeling that comes with it is just a kind of a sort of a calm, you know, like just like a, it's like a soberness that comes. You're just kind of just to see, oh, okay, mm-hmm. It's just the nature of how your body is.
Would that be the sort of image that you would call to mind when you're contemplating the dissolution of the body?
That's right, yes. Mm. Absolutely. You know, I mean, that's one aspect of the dissolution of the body. Mm. Yeah. So this the contemplation of the corpse, of course, is contemplation of impermanence, right? And that's where impermanence sort of its home. Yeah, not just a philosophical concept anymore. Yeah. Anna. Yeah, my teacher Ajahn Chachai, that kind of thing is very common in Thailand, a lot of people do it. My teacher Ajahn Chachai says he recommends against it. He says it's not a good idea. And I think that there's good reasons for that. I think that when you see just like an image, it's kind of disconnected. You know, it's disconnected from the person. And I don't really think it's a good idea. I think it's you know, you can use your imagination. I mean, we all know what it's like. We know what death looks like, even if we haven't seen it very commonly ourselves. And you know, we can use our mind and we sort of know what that's like and so on. I think it's much better than looking at the images. Yeah. I think it can be okay. The best thing to do, you know, if you get the chance, you know, you go somewhere like India or something like that, you can go to Benares and go to the burning ghats, and then you can actually see the process going on there. And it has a very different feel because you realize it's a person, you know? It's not so disconnected. It's a person. It's just like me and the sort of the whole, it's the whole kind of sensory reality of it.
That was great. I did that at Baranasi and it had a lot of meaning actually, the family. I had the most peculiar rave with, I don't know what the title is, the guy that the Pi Master, or, you know, he would settle all
the okay, okay.
Whatever the title that is. But he had the heaviest life I've ever. You'd think the opposite, but I just remember he had such a heavy vibe.
So the guy who was doing the burning?
Yes, that was his job.
Right, and he had a very heavy vibe?
Yes.
Why would you think the opposite? Surely you expected to have a heavy vibe. He's a body burner. If someone's going to have a heavy vibe, surely it'll be the body burner.
It could be a little bit of actually just what we've been saying today.
Okay,
so. In context,
okay.
Having a coolness toward the whole thing.
Okay.
That's his main job.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
but heavy in what sense? I got
that. Just in every sense. His face, he looked sad. He looked just, okay, whatever heavy means. He looked very intense. He looked.
Okay.
Yeah, he just didn't seem average, like this is my job, or slightly detached and a freedom from it.
Yeah.
That's good. got a question in regards to the element.
Sure.
Is there a recognition in the tradition that some elements are more subtle to subjects of meditation than others? I remember reading the Siddha Marga that breath meditation was considered only a suitable subject for Buddhism and Buddhist science because it's so hard to.
Yeah, it's an interesting passage, but generally, yes, the elements, like most of the things in Buddhism, they have a structure. The earth element more coarse, water element more subtle, air element more subtle again, and of course the space element the most subtle of all.
Because I've always found breath meditation not so easy to do compared to that day. Just feeling your body or something.
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, that's why to do something like, say, walking meditation, you're just aware of the postures of walking, and just, you know, until your mind feels reasonably calm and so on, then you can sit and then do some breath meditation. But it is a good point, you know, if you are struggling with breath meditation and it's not clear or something like that, then try to do meditation on something that's more coarse and more obvious. Yeah. Yes.
About routine. So if you go to accessory game course or putting there, what about road kills?
Road kills? Sure. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking of.
Slow down to the kitchen table.
Well, no, because I don't see it. The road.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a human road kill.
Absolutely, you know, and you know, even just like insects or whatever in your home, and you know, you see, okay, it's just the same nature, you know, and you see the animals are tired. I mean, if you're living at all anywhere that's in a rural place, certainly in Australia, you see that all the time. Yeah, and it's just nature.
Go on here if you want one.
Dead beetle. Dead beetle, huh? Not dead kangaroo. So we do have this little brother. You know, this way of hiding things that always kind of strikes me when I'm driving around in Australian cities and you see the billboards for white lady funerals. Yeah. Manages to be both racist and sexist at the same time. I always look at that and a woman's understanding. I think that, you know, I'd never disrobe, I'd never want to disrobe, but if I did disrobe, I'd start a funeral service called Black Man Funeral. And get these big black dudes with sunglasses. And playing like hip hop or something like that. It's really popular.
The way I've
got
the same,
can
ignore it.
Okay, yeah, there's a monopoly on the dead. Yeah, that's kind of creepy.
I know a biker, former biker, criminal, who's done his calling, but you know, he's spiritual now.
Okay. Yeah. My grandfather was a funeral director.
Yeah. Thank you for spiritual. Had a violent life and formed. He's generally a spiritual now.
Okay. Funny.
I'm getting into the conversation on the
evidence.
Is that, do you take one element at a time when you do the meditation, or do you choose all of it at the same time?
Best to start by doing one at a time and start with the earth element. You can start with any of them, and if you feel a particular affinity for them, you can start with that. You can also start either internally or externally. Like this practice is looking mainly at the starting of the internal, so you're contemplating how it feels inside your own body. But you can also do it by like contemplating the water in the cup or something like that. Or just sort of go outside and just sort of sit on the ground and just sort of feel the earth and contemplate that earth element, right? So you can actually do it by getting direct contact with those elements, yeah? And So, but typically the best thing to do is to meditate on one particular element until that's as clear as possible. Okay? Now you can stick with that. I mean, you know, the whole Dhamma is, remember, we looked at the Mahāhatipadokkhama Sutta and we saw how Sariputta sort of started out with the whole Dhamma and then went in, and then you realize even in just one little part, actually all of the Dhamma is in that little part. Yeah? So it's the same thing with any meditation, right? You can see one thing, and actually that's impermanent and it's dukkha and it's not self, right? So you can see the whole Dhamma even within one thing, right? But so you can just keep, if you find that one element is sort of drawing it in, then your mind is happy to stay focused with that element, then you can just stay there. Or else if you like, you can look at the different elements, yeah, and try to get like a distinct sort of feel in your mind. So you keep your mind put with that image and that feel. You get like a feel of the property of that particular element, what it feels like. And then you get that for each of the different elements, and then you can kind of, you can play around with that. So you can compare one element to the other. So once you have the clear image of each individual one, then you can start comparing and say, what is air compared to water like? You know, what are these different elements? And then combine them, and you see like the relationships between them. And so that's when you're starting to see that these things are like interdependent. Mm-hmm. They're not completely separate things. So we can separate them out to some degree, right? So we can understand and contemplate them. But in reality, they always exist interdependently. Okay, very good. So we've been going for a couple of hours already, so let's wrap it up for this morning. And we can do some more meditation before the meeting time.